This is Pacifica Radio's Assault on Peace, Invasion of Iraq, a collaborative broadcast of WPFW, WBAI, KPFK, KPFA, and KPFT. I'm Verna Avery Brown in Washington. While the U.S. launches a second round of bombs over Baghdad, the skies over the Iraqi capital of Baghdad are dark at this hour. Earlier today, the nighttime skies were lit up with fires triggered from a massive U.S. bombing campaign for the second straight night. Ground troops attacked Iraqi forces in the desert with artillery in a slow escalation of the war to drive Saddam Hussein from power. Iraqi missiles fell in Kuwait. Half a world away from the scene of war, U.S. intelligence officials sought to determine whether the Iraqi leader had been killed hours earlier in the pre-dawn attack by cruise missiles and precision-guided bombs. Saddam Hussein appeared on Iraqi television last night and mentioned the date. In the capital, red and white anti-aircraft tracers lit the sky, and a huge plume of smoke rose into the night from the west bank of the Tigris River in central Baghdad. Joining us on the phone line from New York is Peace Watch correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who's lived and worked in Baghdad for several months. Jeremy, what was going through your mind as you watched the television coverage of this horrific bombing campaign over the city of Baghdad earlier today, a city where you lived, met the people there, and perhaps made some friends?
Well, I was very sad and horrified to see the bombs dropping in neighborhoods where I know people. I had a chance to talk to some ordinary Iraqis that I've gotten to know over the past 5 years in my trips to Iraq, and they're very, very scared, I can tell you, Verna. The Iraqis are very fond of saying that the wet man is not afraid of the rain. The Iraqis have known nothing but war for the past 20 years, but they also know that this shock and awe is going to be something of a scale that they've never witnessed. I think people are at a loss as to what to do right now. No one is going to the shelters because the U.S. in 1991 bombed the Al Amariya shelter, killing 400 people, incinerating them alive in that bomb shelter in a neighborhood in Baghdad. People are not going to shelters. They are in their homes bracing. I also have to say, Verna, that I think people are very, very nervous about the prospect of a civil war should Saddam Hussein be taken out, or even if he's not taken out, that there would be a cutoff of the centers of control in Iraq that would create chaos and potentially spark looting and rioting and perhaps anti-government uprisings in Baghdad.
Jeremy, U.S. intelligence is scrambling to determine whether Saddam Hussein may have been injured or killed by the last bombing. Are you familiar enough with the lay of the land to know how close these strikes may have come to any locations that Saddam Hussein may have been dwelling in?
Well, we have to remember that since 1979, when Saddam Hussein took power, his primary concern in Iraq has been protecting himself, protecting his power, protecting his regime. He is the master of escaping these kinds of situations, perhaps more so than any world figure today. So I think that we shouldn't underestimate his ability to endure these initial days, at the very least, of U.S. bombing. I would be very surprised if Saddam Hussein is in any of the places that U.S. intelligence believes he is in. I'd be very surprised if he is anywhere near any of the presidential compounds or presidential residences. He has multiple security forces that are essentially spying on each other. He's the only one who knows what each of those wings is doing. So I think that the United States is underestimating Saddam Hussein. If they truly think that they killed him last night in that strike or injured him last night in that strike, it's not to say, Verna, that that the U.S. forces will not catch up with him at some point, just to say that we should not underestimate his ability to survive, especially in the early stages of this bombing.
Jeremy, it's extremely difficult to get a telephone line into Baghdad today. We heard, however, in an earlier report in our Pacifica coverage that has lasted throughout today, throughout the day, where a correspondent, I believe her name is Mei Ying, said she was required to stand out in a parking lot in order to use her cell phone. What kind of restrictions were placed on journalists by the Saddam Hussein government, Jeremy?
Yes, this was Mei Ying Welsh, an independent journalist and filmmaker that I worked very closely with in Iraq. She is outside of the Ministry of Information. Most of the time when people watch CNN or MSNBC or other major networks, those reporters are speaking from their hotel rooms. Mei Ying is out in the parking lot with many of the Arab journalists. She's not required to be there in order to speak on her satellite phone. She has a choice between there and her hotel, and she chose to be out closer to where people are, and I think at great personal risk to herself. But let's not be under any illusions. The Iraqi government is absolutely in control of all movements of journalists right now. And what Mei Ying said earlier on the broadcast is that she attempted to use her satellite phone in an unauthorized location and was swooped in by secret Iraqi intelligence officers. Even you can hear on CNN Nick Robertson talking about how he is under censorship and certain guidelines within Iraq, not even allowed to name the sites where clearly U.S. missiles have hit. We have seen over the last couple of weeks, as I was leaving Baghdad, a change in the personnel who were responsible for essentially monitoring journalists. Many of the Ministry of Information guides that are normally traveling with journalists were replaced by agents of the Muhabarat, the secret Iraqi intelligence force. So I think people are under extreme watch right now in Baghdad.
Jeremy, it's been feared all along that if backed into a corner, Saddam Hussein might use chemical weapons to defend himself. Has there been any evidence thus far that he may have taken that tactic, according to reports that you may be monitoring?
Well, you know, Verna, when I was leaving Baghdad, many Iraqis, when I would ask them the simple question, what are you most afraid of? The first thing people would say was the massive U.S. bombing and a potential U.S. invasion followed perhaps by a civil war. But people also raised a fear that if the government is destabilized and if Iraqis rise up, particularly Iraqi Shiite Muslims rise up in Baghdad, they fear that Saddam Hussein would use chemical or biological weapons against them if he had them. Many people referred to remarks that they say Saddam Hussein made in 1993 in which he allegedly said that if he was going to die, he would turn Baghdad into a desert. And indeed, some of the Iraqis who I know that fled Baghdad in the weeks that led up to this bombing said that one of their primary reasons for leaving was that they feared that non-conventional weapons would be used by the Iraqi government. In fact, some Iraqis say they believe that's what George W. Bush wants to happen so that he can say, ha, we were right. Saddam Hussein had these weapons all along.
Any signs that the Iraqi people were protecting themselves or purchasing equipment that might protect themselves from the use of any chemical weapons?
It's not available in Baghdad, Verna. It's very sad. People were buying basic masks that are used in surgeries and other things, and that just is not going to help you in the event of a chemical or biological attack. I mean, to be quite honest with you, Verna, I mean, you and I have worked together for a long time. I was in Iraq in 1998, and we spoke a lot then, and I have to say that one of the defining factors in why I decided to leave Baghdad is because I'm afraid of that potential, and we don't have independent journalists don't have the tens of thousands of dollars required to purchase those kinds of suits, and I think that after consulting with people, felt that it was the best move to leave Baghdad, and many journalists are in the same position, and that's why they've left as well.
Yes, Jeremy, and we sincerely and certainly do appreciate and acknowledge your decision and honor the decision that you made. We would like to acknowledge your fine work as a journalist in that region as well. Jeremy Scahill reporting from New York City. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Verna.
Have a good evening.
You too.
With more than 250,000 troops, 1,000 combat aircraft, and a naval armada in the Persian Gulf region, administration officials said the full-scale invasion was just over the horizon. Wayne Mattson is a senior fellow at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, formerly with the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan. He attended the press briefing today at the Pentagon for Peace Watch. Wayne is joining us in the studio this evening. Wayne, is this the shock and awe campaign that we've heard so much about?
Well, Verna, I don't think we've seen shock and awe yet. As advertised, shock and awe will consist of 3,500 precision-guided missiles and bombs hitting Iraq almost continuously. What we've seen so far with the video footage out of Baghdad is basically what we've seen before with the night scope and a few headlights in the background and a few anti-aircraft fire and a few reports of explosions. So we haven't seen the shock and awe quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were over at the Pentagon today, probably during a time when some of these bombs were being launched. What was the mood like there?
Well, the mood, it was a very large press conference. Even Secretary Rumsfeld made note of the fact that it was very crowded in there. Most of the questions weren't able to be asked. They limited the questions to about 15 or so. So it was the mood at the Pentagon was one of those that you would expect all over Washington. There's a lot of anticipation about the the upcoming war, and the press was there in force.
Mm. And were the questions what you would consider to be tough questions being asked of Secretary Rumsfeld?
The questions were really, I wouldn't consider they were very tough. And Rumsfeld, of course, in his typical manner, managed to avoid getting into any details, deferring to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, for anything that was of any technical nature. But mostly the press conference was sort of a grandstanding performance by Mr. Rumsfeld.
Mr. Rumsfeld issued a warning to Iraqi soldiers during that press briefing this morning. Here's exactly what he said.
Do not follow orders to destroy dams or flood villages. Do not follow orders to destroy your country's oil. Following such orders would be to commit crimes against the Iraqi people. Those who follow orders to commit such crimes will be found and they will be punished. War crimes will be prosecuted, and it will be no excuse to say, I was just following orders.
Donald Rumsfeld. Wayne, you're a former naval officer, and you worked for the National Security Agency and the State Department. Based on your knowledge and experience, do these fall into the category of war crimes, in your opinion?
Yeah, I was really taken aback by Rumsfeld's saying that anyone who would follow military orders to destroy dams first and then oil installations second would fall into the category of a war crime. Usually war crimes are acts of genocide, mass murder. This seemed to be a new extension of what crimes are considered crimes against humanity or war crimes. I have never heard any government official before indicate that destroying targets in a scorched earth policy was in any way, shape, or form a war crime.
Mm. Rumsfeld also cautioned Iraqi civilians, telling them not to go to work or near any military targets. Many fear a humanitarian catastrophe is likely. Have you heard what measures the U.S. military is taking in this regard?
What I've heard is basically it has to do with the beaming of radio and television broadcasts directly to the Iraqis, telling them they should remain home, that they should not resist. The information, it's a full court press as far as a psychological warfare campaign. Also, they're trying to tell members of the Iraqi military not to follow orders to basically lay down their arms. So most of this, what we see right now with this war is a huge psychological warfare psyops campaign directed against not only the government of Iraq, but also the Iraqi people.
Throughout this entire scenario, There's a sense of arrogance and confidence on the part of the Bush administration and, of course, Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. How would you define the mood there today?
Well, Rumsfeld, I think, was also practicing a little bit of psychological warfare operation against those in the administration who disagree with administration policy. He emphasized on several occasions towards the end of the news conference that leaks of classified information will not be tolerated. And he ended it by saying, just don't do it. Obviously, this is based on the fact there's been a leak of a classified State Department report to the LA Times.
Sounds like a threat.
Yes. And there was a leak of a NSA memorandum indicating we were bugging our allies on the UN Security Council. So obviously, what Rumsfeld was saying, and off to the side, they actually had an old World War II poster saying, please don't say anything. It's a little girl, don't say anything that will hurt my daddy or kill my daddy. This was actually on a screen, a plasma screen, next to Rumsfeld and Myers at the press conference.
Wayne Madsen, a senior fellow at the Electronic Privacy Information Center and a former congressional you've worked with congressional committees on legislation, and you've also worked with the National Security Agency. Thank you very much for your perspective and your coverage today, Wayne.
Good to be with you.
The Boston Globe reports today that the U.S. is considering the use of landmines in Iraq. The prevailing conventional wisdom is that landmines are dangerous because they cannot discriminate between enemy combatants and civilians. The U.S. has failed to sign the treaty banning the use of landmines, which puts them at odds with Britain and a number of other NATO members. Peace Watch spoke with Gina Copeland-Newfield of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines earlier today, who was responsible for calling the U.S. attention to use of landmines to the public's attention.
We hope that they will not use landmines. The U.S. military has not used anti-personnel landmines in combat since the Persian Gulf War in 1991. They didn't use them in Afghanistan, and they didn't use them in Kosovo. However, we do know two things that suggest that they will indeed use them in Iraq this time around. One is we found out in December that the U.S. military had transferred about 90,000 landmines to the Gulf region, to countries like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Qatar. Two, and this is what prompted the Boston Globe story today, is that there was a senior Pentagon official who announced at a Pentagon briefing recently that landmines may indeed be used by the military. And this was the first time that an official from the Pentagon had made such an announcement in a public way.
Now, 140 countries have banned these interpersonnel landmines. What is the reason for that?
Well, 146 nations around the world have joined the Mine Ban Treaty. 131 of them have ratified it. This is an overwhelming global norm that outlaws the use, production, trade, and stockpile of this indiscriminate weapon. And the reason is pretty clear. 80% of the victims of this weapon are innocent civilians. They are farmers, they're children, they're women traveling to market, and overwhelmingly they are people in very poor countries with very limited access to medical care. And so the world came together in the mid to late 90s to ban this horrible weapon. And unfortunately, the United States was not part of that movement and was not a signatory to the treaty. President Clinton failed to sign the 1997 Mine Ban Treaty, but what he did do was indicate that the U.S. would join the treaty by the year 2006, and in the meantime, we would make progress on the issue in a variety of ways. The Bush administration has not yet come out with their official U.S. landmine policies. They have been in the process of reviewing the issue since early in the administration. But these new indications that they've transferred mines to the Gulf region and that they may well be planning to use them, it's very disturbing. It's disturbing considering the fact that they may well maim and kill innocent Iraqi civilians. Mm-hmm. They may well injure and kill U.S. troops. And, of course, they will be a major hazard and cost to future peacekeepers and deminers.
Now, according to this article in the Boston Globe published today, it's intended that to minimize civilian casualties during and after an assault, the U.S. military doctrine is calling for almost all mines to include timers that cause them to self-destruct after a preset period.
Right.
And some of them will actually, in addition to self-destructing, they have other features on them, computer-controlled landmines that would actually disarm themselves even if the timers fail.
Right.
Is that progress? I mean, does that minimize the risk to innocent civilians? As you said, women going to the market, children playing?
Well, self-destructing anti-personnel landmines are certainly better than non-self-destructing mines. These so-called smart mines, however, are not as modern and not as smart and precise as they may sound. No landmine, whether so-called smart or dumb, is smart enough to tell the difference between the foot of a soldier and that of a child. So while these so-called smart mines are better, there are a few reasons why they are, one, banned by the Mine Ban Treaty and by the majority of the world's nations, and two, why they're very dangerous to civilians. First of all, if you have a situation of conflict and you have people fleeing from areas of conflict, it's not going to matter much to them if a mine is set to go off in a day or two. If they encounter that mine, it's going to injure and kill them that day. Two is that these types of so-called smart mines tend to be scattered by air by the thousands, so they're very difficult to mark and map. Three is that there is a dud rate, so some of these mines may not self-destruct, may not self-deactivate. And four, for demining teams, they need to treat an area with so-called smart mines with the same degree of caution, time, and resources as they would a so-called dumb mine field, because they're not going to want to take the chance in case there are duds or in case they've received improper intelligence.
President Bush has said repeatedly that they will take every precaution to prevent the loss of innocent lives and civilians. Is this a realistic statement with the use of these landmines and the nature of their capabilities?
Well, we work with retired military leaders who say that more often than not, landmines are more of a hindrance than a help on the modern battlefield. They slow operational tempo. So there are certainly military reasons in and of themselves to not use this weapon, but of course the humanitarian reasons are the most compelling reasons not to use this weapon. So indications that suggest that the U.S. military is planning to use this weapon in Iraq and that President Bush is prepared to authorize their use brings into question, you know, how serious our government is about protecting civilian life and about respecting a global norm that has outlawed this weapon.
Could the indiscriminate killing of civilians and the use of these landmines in and of themselves be considered a war crime?
Well, the U.S. is not party to the mine ban treaty, and so, you know, they would maintain that they're allowed to use this weapon. So I think it would be a difficult time of trying to prove that it would be a war crime to use these weapons.
How does the Pentagon and the U.S. justify using these weapons and not signing on to that treaty that 146 countries have signed on to?
Well, that question I think you'll have to ask the Pentagon themselves.
You haven't heard the arguments.
Well, of course. I mean, they maintain that we don't have enough alternatives and that we may need to use mines in specific military scenarios. But again, we work with retired military leaders who say that that's simply not true and that there are more political factors at work here when it comes to this issue. You know, the Pentagon may well feel that if the public makes them give up anti-personnel landmines today, what is the public going to make them give up tomorrow? It's the so-called slippery slope theory of arms control.
There are, in fact, several not-so-smart mines still laying wait in fields throughout the world at this time, left over from previous wars, are there not?
Yes, and in Iraq, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of anti-personnel landmines in the ground, and they will certainly be a risk to U.S. troops who will be entering those areas.
Gina Coplin-Newfield of the U.S. Campaign to Ban Landmines. You're listening to a Pacifica Radio special edition of Peace Watch, Assault on Peace, Invasion of Iraq. This is a collaborative broadcast of WPFW, WBAI, KPFA, KPFK, and KPFT. I'm Verna Avery Brown. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we invite you to visit our website at www.pacifica.org.